You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Burning questions.
Insightful answers.
Listener's Choice.
With Clement Maniatela.
And, you know, our Listener's Choice feature is all about you curating the content of the show with us. It's your opportunity. Maybe there's something we're not touching on, or maybe a subject matter we've not sufficiently delved into and discussed, and you want us to dedicate some time to talk about, or it's something maybe that we've never even touched on. You send me an email on cm@702.co.za, and every single Wednesday after the news at 11, we line up one topic coming from you as a listener that you want us to discuss. We got an email from a listener who's asked that we discuss recession. We have been in and out of technical recessions where our economy suffers two consecutive quarters of negative economic performance. But you have other economists who believe we've been in recession since around 2013. So I want us to look at the things that can trigger the recession, you know, things like the declining economic activity, you know, too much inflation, excessive debt, things that contribute to the shrinking of economic output. We have an economy now that experienced another form of a trigger, a sudden economic shock like the pandemic, and it's still trying to recover. In fact, some are predicting that the economy may only get back to pre-COVID-19 levels by 2025. If you've got questions around recessions, you know, what happens when we are in a technical recession, what government can do to get us out of a technical recession when we are in one, you're welcome to give us a call. Send us a voice note as well. I'll get my guest to respond to some of them. Kanti Pai is the guest this morning. He's an economist and founding director at Nassens Advisory and Research. Kanti, thank you for making time. Good morning.
Good morning, Clement. Very good to talk to you, and good morning to 702 Land.
So I remember a politician saying, we're just in a technical recession. It's not really a full-blown, so relax. What's the difference when you're in a technical recession? Is it really a big deal, or is the politician right that it's not so much?
You know, I think it's actually an interesting question, because I think, you know, what we name things is very, very important, because it actually speaks to how we respond. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that, especially even when we talk about employment. Recessions are a big deal. And actually, by the time we record the numbers, they would have already been, because remember, the numbers are just helping us sort of identify something. So if you think about when you are sick, right, it's not that the doctor tells you that you are sick. You already know you are sick. Yeah. You already feel sick. It's just to go there now to find out exactly what's the problem and how we can actually respond. And with regards to recessions, there's two broad definitions. The one is American, and then the other one is British. The Americans look at it in a much more broader way, because what they do is to think about it as a recession is a period where you have a decline in economic activity, and then they look at various groups of numbers. So they will look at different production levels. They look at trade, they look at retail sales, those kinds of numbers, and then they say for a couple of months, they look at say several months of this or a few months, they call it a recession. And they are very clear about that, because I think they recognize that you don't want to actually wait 6 months, which is about, you know, two consecutive quarters, to first say, well, actually maybe this patient is sick. And I think in their context, it is the British who actually are very sort of delayed about it, where they look at two consecutive quarters. But even there, they look at it in the sense that this should be seasonally adjusted. So they say, look, if for two quarters are seasonally adjusted, that means we have looked at these numbers, and actually there's nothing in the data that suggests, for example, that there's something specific about this, or, you know, for example, the season that we're in, or there's something special. They look at it and say, look, actually, we are really, really now in trouble. So they want to know that there's actual serious trouble. We seem to have adopted the second part, which is about the seasonally the British one, which is two consecutive quarters. And I do think it's a mistake to actually do that, because as soon as you start to see problems in the economy, especially where there are possible responses, one should actually look into that. So if, for example, it's consumers and retail sales that are starting to decline, our production, or you're starting to see job losses in particular indicators, and in a wide variety of data, I think it's important to start to say, look, what can we do? Because really the whole point of measuring these things is to be able to respond in a timely manner and be effective. But really those are the two definitions.
All right. So speaking of responding, How have we responded in the past when we have had a technical recession? I know in the past government has introduced a stimulus package and they were like, yeah, it's going to inject growth into our economy. I don't know how far that went. But do we normally respond timeously? And does it work to just wait for, okay, now that we're in a technical recession, let's quickly hold a meeting and see how we respond?
Well, I mean, I think this has been one of the big discussions, because I guess, you know, there are two paths to respond, right, in terms of at least the officials. And then there's another way, which of course, you know, this would be, for example, in our monetary policy and our fiscal policy. So one, for example, trying to direct spending, increasing budgets, or pushing certain kinds of spending to happen. So, for example, you would want, say, you are in a, you know, to maybe accelerate spending on housing or increase more money in terms of, in the way that the U.S. does it. Interest rates, for example, could be relaxed, depending on, of course, the policy of the country. In our country, it's a difficult thing to do because we also watch very, very closely inflation trends. So there are a number of tools. The Chinese are very clear. They tend to inject money into the system. So banks start lending a little bit more because they feel like they are not going to meet the targets of their growth targets. So these kinds of things are possible. But of course, it depends really on the government and what they think. Because also part of it is also to look ahead and say, is this a temporary shock or is this something we can look through? Or should we actually respond? Because this could turn into, I guess, what we know to be a depression, which actually gets then a little bit more sustained. Again, I guess it also depends on what your outlook is in terms of, is this just something temporary or is it something that is could be long-term? But I think the information that we look at is also important, because one of the things it tells us is that actually, is there a symptom of something bigger? Again, this idea of looking at our, you know, is using the parallel of our health. You know, it's one thing to be, you know, to be sick for a little bit while. Do you want to go and get tested and actually start, you know, taking some medication to look into that? Should we change our diet because this thing could last longer? Should we actually exercise? There's a number of things that I think are important, but it really depends on the perspective. So the example you give of the politician is very important, because actually tells us something about how the politician may understand those that the two quarters as something temporary or as something indicative of a deeper problem that we need to attend to. Because actually the waves that we see actually seem to be a little bit more than they should be. And so if we see one and then it's broken in one quarter, then we think, ah, we are out of a recession, when actually we are still not out. We've just maybe have had a reprieve in one or the other number that may actually take over.
And sometimes the reprieve doesn't even last that long. What's the greater impact, Kanti, on as a result of the recession? I'm just thinking unemployment. I'm thinking about the poverty crisis we have. What happens during that economic recession, and what are the socio-economic challenges particularly that are worsened as a result of that?
So people, when they look at these numbers, right, they start to respond. So as I said at the beginning, you'll see like, well, actually, you know, this thing, you've already been experiencing it. You know, people have perhaps been losing jobs. You know, companies have been looking at their revenues have been declining. So people have already seen this thing is happening. But then they start to see it in confirmed in numbers. Then they start to think about the future and how they plan. So some businesses say, well, if the economy is doing badly, maybe I should not actually be hiring more people, because maybe this thing is going to last. So then they start holding back plans to hire people. They hold back plans to invest, for example, in new infrastructure and new inventories. They don't stock up, because they think, well, actually, we are in a recession now. It's better that I hold back, because actually what's going to happen is that I don't want to actually suffer losses. And of course, that has, and then individuals do the same, right? If you hear we are in a recession, you are most likely not to start spending or borrowing to perhaps build that house you wanted to build, or you are not likely to, you know, to buy new clothes, or, you know, to spend more, because you want to be careful, you know, because what if this thing actually leads to a job loss? What if this thing needs you to respond in a particular way? So then people start holding back, and they tend to then get more, you know, worse outcomes. So the implication, therefore, is that you can start to see, you know, job losses. You can start to see or no job gains. So, you know, more poverty, and then people, of course, spend less, then unprofitability. So then the economy stands in a limbo. So I think it is important to start to understand very clearly and communicate. And I think many governments will do this, whether they are talking, you know, on fiscal services or on monetary policy, to start to communicate about, look, we are not really worried about this, because what's happening is that we think it's a temporary shock, so people spend still a little bit more to think, okay, let's keep going because this is not an issue. I think what is really, really important is that we have an understanding, and that understanding is clear and shared amongst everyone that actually this is temporary, so let's keep going, let's keep living. Or if people might feel that this is not, then it's that obviously trying to find some ways to inspire people to spend, to invest, so that we can actually come out of the recession. We can have, of course, government intervention. So I think it's important to understand really where we are, because the implications can be long-lasting. And so then now suddenly, you know, people are holding back. They're not investing because they're not sure. Mm. And then one of them, and then in 1 month or one quarter, we receive, for example, a big order that comes in the mining sector, and then mining pushes up the economy, and suddenly we're out of the recession. But in real sense, you know, other sectors are still struggling. And so one of the things that it gives you is this idea that, well, we are out, everything is fine. And politicians like to do that very much, where, you know, you see one quarter of a reprieve, and they say, look, we are now, you know, the agricultural sector is buoyant, we are doing better. And we have to be very, very careful about that, because obviously in different sectors, it is important to understand what are the dynamics, because people are not really employed in the big economy. They are employed sector by sector, and those have different dynamics.
Yeah, I've got questions coming from the listeners now. 011-883-0702. What questions do you have around a recession, or maybe input? And you want to call in and give us your inputs on WhatsApp, you can send your voice notes on 072-702-1702.
And our lovely economist, the question I would like to direct to the economist is, what is the difference between economic downturn and recession? So the government sometimes says it will employ austerity measures. So what is the impact of these austerity measures on recession? I am Howard from Rafisha. Good morning, lovely people.
All right. Thank you so much for your questions. Tanti, I think that's twofold. One, the difference between economic downturn and recession. And he also wants to know what the impact of austerity measures is on recession.
Yeah. So austerity, a downturn and a recession, they tend to speak to the same thing, right? So we are actually seeing an economic downturn. So we are, you know, a slowdown, for example, in economic activity. So whereas maybe we would have been seeing growth in the economy, would have been seeing, more production, producing, South Africa has been producing more cars, we've been seeing the agricultural sector producing more, then we're saying, you know, things are going, so the economy is growing. Then when that slows down and it starts to actually see those sectors contracting and the economy as a whole contracting, then we say we're in a downturn or a recession. As I said, it depends, of course, whose definition you want to use, but a downturn or a recession, whether it's a few months where production has contracted, where we've seen, some people's sales have contracted, then people say, well, we are in a downturn. And of course, austerity really speaks to, traditionally the spending of government. And when government cuts spending, in economies like ours, especially where government spending is so dominant, once government starts to reduce their spending, you start to see that other businesses, because many businesses, for example, will work with government in building infrastructure. They work with government in delivering certain services to government. So when government holds back a little bit or starts to withdraw their spending, that can lead to an economic downturn, because the economy is so perhaps largely dependent on what government does. So we hear a lot, for example, in our country where businesses will say, we are still waiting for government to, you know, to release that infrastructure spend. We want government to release this kind of spending. And government starts to spend on services, because many businesses are tied to that, even though they may have their own private sector work, but they still do a lot of work with government. So when government withdraws a little bit of their spending, that tends to then see those businesses also withdraw investment, withdraw hiring, and that can lead to an economic downturn. It really speaks to, of course, how big that is and in what ways that it does. You know, austerity sometimes can be, we are not hiring as many people, or we are reducing the government workforce. Remember, the workforce also spends in the economy. And so when you start to withdraw that, then of course that can have an impact on the economy, and therefore you can see an economic downturn.
Yeah, then you take away that buying power. Lesoho says, Clement, I've been arguing that South Africa has been in recession for at least the last decade. I say this because on average, the population has been growing faster than the economy. Setting aside the Gini coefficient argument, what is Clement's view on this?
I think it's an interesting discussion that's been had by many economists and many people actually and commentators on this idea of the growth of the population above the rate of economic growth. Because actually what one of the things we should be those of us who have populations that grow, where we have young people that are coming on board, actually should be growing, because if you think about it, we have a bigger workforce, a much more energetic workforce, and therefore that should give us growth. And so in South Africa, I guess, because of the challenges that we have with our education system, our training ability, our health system, to make sure that, of course, we have a healthy population that is able and available for work, and the other challenges that we face, that has actually looked differently, and that speaks maybe perhaps to growth per capita, that actually we are growing, but that growth is not shared. So basically, we are growing in smaller sections of the economy, and usually the people who work in this country are people who have jobs above the age of 35. Those are the more productive people. Those people who are younger are less productive, 70% of them unemployed. So, of course, that means something about our economy, because if you started to see whatever number the people over the age of 35 are producing and working to contribute to the economy, if we were to divide that up by everybody, then it starts to look small, very, very small, and sort of not sustainable. So I think it's quite correct that our population growth is really completely out of line with what we should get in terms of the what many people will call the demographic dividend, where actually your demographic population is growing, especially it's got a lot of youth, and so it should actually grow, because remember, workforce is a huge resource, and many countries have used that very well in order to actually inspire wealth creation and growth. In our country, because of the various challenges, both current and historical, we have these kinds of problems where actually, this is not something, it is something that detracts from growth rather than adds to it. I think it's one of actually the most tragedies that any country has ever seen.
Mbazi Mashiloa on Twitter says, we are not known for taking any action after the jobs and economic numbers. Your thoughts? I would argue we are sometimes known for taking action and announcing these bold plans. I mean, how many economic reconstruction plans have been announced? Treasury at some point had this big announcement around an economic reconstruction plan. If you ask whatever happened to that, or even the stimulus package that was once announced and what the implementation levels are, there's probably little ground that's been covered.
Look, I think one of the things also sometimes is the shoot and miss. I think one of the things I was saying earlier is we have to look at the numbers and understand what exactly is going on in the economy. Why do we have this problem? So that we can actually target the responses properly. So, for example, I mean, you remember the president's stimulus package of $500 billion, had big chunks of money that were going to sectors and missing the point. So, for example, that money didn't go to small businesses because it said small businesses should be on good terms with their bank. So, and by that time, remember, banks were already in recession. So if somebody says, here is money to support you as a stimulus package, but you can't apply for this money if you are struggling, because obviously you're missing payments in your bank and all of that. So they say, but you who you actually most needed can apply. Then we also give money to people who, for example, have had jobs. And we don't give anything for people, for example, who have been in the informal sector. And remember, during that period, a lot of people in the informal sector were staying home and we couldn't find them, as opposed to those people who could apply for the funding that was available through the unemployment insurance fund. So we have all of these interventions sometimes, and they miss. And then sometimes they say, we'll give you a tax break so that you can actually keep your business up. But if you are struggling with your business, a tax break is not useful to you, because it actually only comes up when you are actually doing your tax return, when you need liquidity now. So we do introduce measures, and sometimes those measures completely miss the point about what is actually happening and what we are trying to solve. And so I think one of the issues is exactly this. So when we talk about recessions, we have to say, what is actually the problem? And therefore, then we have to have something appropriate that actually addresses the problem, rather than to just look at numbers. And maybe that actually speaks, even when we think about unemployment, right? Another number that we use a lot, whether or not we are unemployment is 30% or 40%, you know, whether we're using the one form of unemployment or the other. It speaks to, of course, should we be asking, because the bigger number tells us that we are, the unemployment rate is because people are not looking for work. So we, and therefore, maybe we should not be targeting those. But then we know also that people don't look for work if they don't have money to look for work. Mm-hmm. So that speaks to, so we have two numbers that are supposed to tell us something about what's happening and how we respond. But if we were to look at those numbers and say, then what would be the response? Would the response be trying to open more opportunities, or would the response be finding ways in which people are able to go look for work? So people can wake up in the morning and maybe have access to transport. So vouchers to transport, for example, might be useful if people are, if that's the reason why people have stopped looking for work, rather than to say, well, let's inspire people. So there are various things where we have to think about what is the number telling us and in which way to respond. And so, again, so the definitions are important because they allow us to respond. But if the definitions are wrong, or we don't understand what the definitions are telling us and the numbers are telling us, then our responses are likely to miss.
Yeah. Then the last question, someone listening is asking, what's the role of ratings agencies in all of this?
Well, I mean, ratings agencies are important only to tell us, to tell investors or lenders to a country what the state of that country is and its ability to pay its debt. So they just say to you, look, if you give South Africa your money, you are likely to get it or you are likely not to get it. Or, you know what I mean? So that's really what it is. It's basically your credit rating, as much as it helps us individuals. For example, when you are, we all have our credit bureau ratings, right? And those are important because when I go and borrow money, they look at credit bureau and they say, client, you should not actually, don't lend this guy money because he's likely not to pay you back. Or lend him, but use a higher interest rate because he may default on you, so he's a high risk. So those are really, that's the role of ratings agents more than anything else.
Ah, Kanti, you've been brilliant. Thank you for making time.
Thank you so much.
Kanti Pai, economist and founding director at Nassens Advisory.